Let's assume you're an excellent driver and you've gone years without so much as a fender bender. You probably won't decide based on that safety record to quit wearing a seatbelt. Because no matter how careful you are behind the wheel, you can't control what anybody else on the road is doing. A crash is not out of the question. Nobody has deployed a nuclear weapon since the U.S. attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki that ended World War II in the Pacific, and very few people still alive remember that horror firsthand. But just because it hasn't happened for 75 years doesn't mean it couldn't happen at any time. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Daniel Immerwahr is Associate Professor of History at Northwestern University. He is no fearmonger, but he does worry that the world has come to accept that multiple countries will stockpile bombs capable of flattening entire cities while not truly considering the risk that somebody might actually use one. His recent essay for The Guardian is titled "Forgetting the Apocalypse: Why Our Nuclear Fears Faded and Why That's Dangerous." Daniel, welcome back to Think.
Thank you so much for having me. It's good to be back.
So the bombings at Hiroshima and Nagasaki helped force the Japanese surrender at the end of World War II, and they were associated with victory in the United States, but nobody could ignore the fact that such weapons now could be dropped anywhere in the world, and it was an agonizing fear to live with.
That's something that surprised me. I had assumed, not having thought too much about it, that the atmosphere in the United States would be one of jubilation. And I had that image of the sailor grabbing a nurse and kissing her, we now know without her consent, as the image of 1945 and August of 1945 in the United States. But if you look at journalism from the time, what you find is that a lot of journalists, both themselves and report this and those around them, feel and notice an extraordinary ambivalence, because it takes 2 seconds of reflection to jump from "this happened to Hiroshima and Nagasaki" to "oh my, this could happen to us."
In hindsight, of course, we know that generation that lived through that moment never had to experience another nuclear strike anywhere, which is a really good thing. But it can start to feel like nuclear fears are this quaint relic of the past, and there's no reason to feel that way.
Yeah, and I think that is a very generational feeling, and I will out myself as a member of the not concerned about nuclear war generation. Not that I don't think we should be concerned about it, but I was born in 1980, I'm 42 now, and I didn't grow up with that fear reinforced, and I think that's true of a lot of people of roughly my age, but we notice, comparing ourselves to other generations, to our parents, for example, that they really grew up with nuclear fear. So there's this kind of, it's a forgetting. And you can see that we've gone from people around the world being fully aware of the danger of nuclear weapons and what that might mean for their lives to a generation and a set of generations where people are intellectually aware, but I think emotionally much more able to shrug it off.
For a while, at least, nuclear weapons were, I don't mean at least like this was a good thing, but nuclear weapons were detonated in remote locations as ways of testing them. We haven't even seen that kind of footage in the news for more than 40 years, though.
That's right. There has not been an atmospheric test since 1980, which is a long time.
To be clear, there are and have been plenty of conventional weapons on this planet capable of destroying huge amounts of territory and infrastructure and killing, countless numbers of people. Why did previous generations fear a nuclear strike in a very different way, even knowing those weapons had existed all along, the conventional weapons that could still wreak havoc?
If your theory is nuclear weapons are scary because they can flatten cities, then if you think about World War II, you realize, oh, they were already flattening cities with what we call conventional weapons, firebombing and explosives and that sort of thing. The difference with nuclear weapons is they just make it easy. And this is something that the nuclear scientists, the atomic scientists who worked on the bomb, noted. And I mean, they sort of struggled with this in secret, but after the secret of the bomb came out, they tried to explain to the country what this meant. They said, once we can mass produce nuclear bombs, you know, it was hard to firebomb Japan, even for the United States. Obviously, it was far more difficult for the Japanese to endure this. But the idea that this could be, just a single payload from a single plane could do that kind of damage that had been done to Tokyo by, many, many sorties, by many planes. That was a scary thought because there's no defending against that.
The other terrifying thing about nuclear war is that despite efforts at fail-safes, we have to recognize it can happen through the actions of like a single rogue leader and a handful of willing subordinates.
Yeah, that is the other thing. There are a lot of "we must never do this again" kind of episodes in the 20th century. The Holocaust is the most prominent example. But, you know, doing that in the case of, you know, a genocide or attempted genocide requires intention, effort, cooperation, coordination. That can't happen by accident. Nuclear war can actually happen by accident. And in fact, not only can it happen by accident, it really seems like there's been times when it came extraordinarily close to having happened by accident.
That is really scary to me because we're not necessarily fully aware of all the almost accidental consequences. You have to sort of pay close attention to history and go looking for these stories. We don't know how close we've come, and it's so much harder to prove a negative, right? That we're lucky that we didn't have this happen.
Right. And it's, you don't know how to think about that because on the one hand, I mean, it's bizarre that no nuclear weapon has been used. They've been tested, but no nuclear weapon has been used since Hiroshima. And one reaction to that might be, my gosh, what an incredible accomplishment on the part of humanity. We took the most dangerous weapon and we collectively, however we did it, managed to not use it again. And that is true. And that should be absolutely celebrated. But the other side of that is the more we learn, and this is something that historians are increasingly uncovering as they're able to get access to declassified materials, there have been a lot of moments when it almost happened. And it seems like some of those moments were not just Cuban Missile Crisis style moments where, you know, the temperature was raised and leaders sort of stared at each other with steely resolve and imagined and contemplated doing a first strike. But actually, there were moments when, for example, and this has happened multiple times, planes carrying nuclear weapons just crashed. And I mean, that's something that can happen. You can crash while carrying a hydrogen bomb. And we've never had a nuclear detonation that way, but it's totally imaginable that we might have.
Surely world leaders have an intellectual understanding, as we all do, right, of the terrifying power of a nuclear warhead. What is lost, though, Daniel, when nobody running any country anywhere in the world has a firsthand memory of the shock of the bombing of Hiroshima?
And I think the way you put it is right. Intellectual understanding. We have an intellectual understanding of 1945 and Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But I think that's different from having an experiential understanding. This is the first generation where no head of a nuclear state can remember Hiroshima. It just happened too long ago. And that has just passed out of living memory for anyone with control of, or the ultimate control of a nuclear weapon. And I think that might be a dangerous thing. And one reason I think that it's a danger is that in that history of almost moments, of moments when things really almost could have gone very wrong and we almost could have had bidirectional nuclear war, it seems like that experiential knowledge, not just intellectual knowledge, has been really important. There's often a moment when someone, you know, who has the power to get the launch keys turning or not, says, just pauses and says, okay, I understand that we're all saying some things that we may regret later, but I just want to remind you, we know what war looks like. And in fact, we know what nuclear war looks like, and we're not going to do that, right? And it seems like that visceral understanding of the consequences of nuclear war has actually been a really important safety valve or safety mechanism. And it may be that we've just lost a guardrail without having noticed it.
I was trying really hard reading your piece to get my head around what all this means and what the fear or lack of fear can mean. And I started thinking about 9/11, which was this extraordinary event and literally changed, you know, a great deal of the way we live in the West. That seems fresher and more possible in our minds than a nuclear strike.
And in some ways, it is, because it's reinforced. So not only was there 9/11, there have been other, you know, moments of, if you want to call them terrorism, domestic terrorism from abroad. There have been things to remind us of that. And there's also been a kind of set of rituals or security procedures that we undergo. Every time you board an airplane, you kind of have to think about 9/11 and the legacy of the war on terror because of, you know, all the, you know, take off your shoes, all that kind of thing. And that used to be the case with nuclear war. There was a lot of daily life that was impinged upon by the possibility of nuclear war. And that's just not the case anymore. So it's really easy to not think about the fact that there are more than 10,000 nuclear warheads in the hands of 9 different nuclear countries.
You note in the piece that Boris Johnson has said he doesn't think Vladimir Putin intends to use the nuclear arsenal at his disposal. Is there any good evidence that would make Johnson think this, or does this amount to kind of wishful thinking of some kind?
It's really hard to tell. So on the one hand, again, no one has used nuclear weapons in anger since Nagasaki. So you might think, okay, well, you know, all these countries have them, but they're not really going to use them. And it's all just sort of a bluff and it's theater. And we can afford to be dismissive of that. And Boris Johnson has been flatly dismissive of the possibility. And maybe that's helpful. Maybe that's a way of reinforcing norms of course, no one, of course, we're not going to do that, right? That is unthinkable. But nuclear experts I've talked to find it incredibly thinkable, very conceivable that Putin might do something. And one route to that I find very plausible is we have different sizes of nuclear weapons. There's what's called strategic ones, which are, you know, designed to do maximum damage to large areas, and what's called tactical nuclear weapons, which are really serious explosives, some of which are actually larger than the ones dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but nevertheless are designed to be conceivably small enough that it is plausible that they could be used, as opposed to the sort of unthinkable large ones. And it's not hard to imagine a scenario with having those tactical nuclear weapons, which Vladimir Putin does, that the West does something that he feels crosses the line and he reaches for a tactical nuke.
When you say, you know, unthinkably large ones, I think it was in the New York Times this morning that I read a piece that said nuclear weapons now exist that are capable of turning all of Great Britain into like a nuclear wasteland.
Yeah, I mean, I don't. So there's a really good simulator by a guy named Alex Wallerstein called Nuke Map. Just Nuke Map. You can just type it into Google, and it allows you to simulate all the kinds of weapons we have. If you do the largest nuclear bomb. I tried bombing my own house in simulation with the largest nuclear bomb ever designed. I live in Chicago in Illinois, and there would be destructive effects, including fallout, not just enveloping Chicago, but that would spread to 3 other states, Indiana, Wisconsin, and Michigan. That's how far the extent of that nuclear blast would be felt.
And I guess we all engage in the kind of the kind of magical thinking that says we could somehow protect ourselves, but there's really not much anybody could do in that situation.
No, I mean, it depends where you are. And, you know, in some way, we mock the duck and cover drills that, you know, my parents were subjected to, but they actually make a kind of sense. It depends on where you are with relation to the blast, but if you're far enough away, the immediate radiation and fallout may be your biggest problem, and actually getting somewhere where you're sort of somewhat protected might help with that. But yeah, I mean, on a daily basis, it's really hard to walk around vigilant against a nuclear strike. I mean, that's a kind of impossibility.
Daniel, President Biden this week issued a pointed warning to Vladimir Putin that any use of a nuclear device against Ukraine would provoke a major response in retaliation, but not necessarily a response in kind, right? Not a nuclear strike. Beyond wanting, surely, to avoid an all-out nuclear war, what is the thinking behind a statement like that behind the Biden administration, do you think?
I imagine that it's to retain some flexibility. It is to reinforce the norm, which badly needs to be reinforced these days, that we don't use nuclear weapons, right? And that no matter how heated a war becomes, nuclear weapons should be off the table, and there will be serious and immense consequences beyond those which Russia is already facing if it goes nuclear. On the other hand, you can see that the Biden administration doesn't want to participate in breaking the norm by saying, if you use nukes, we'll use them too, because that leads to an all-out nuclear war, which is the most horrifying possibility imaginable. So I see an attempt to threaten strongly, but not actually to name that this would lead to an all-out nuclear war, which is, of course, something that Biden seems desperate to prevent.
Is there any reason to think that reads to the Putin administration as a kind of tacit acknowledgement that it might happen and that they won't be struck back with the same intensity?
Yeah, you could read that as permissive. It's hard. I mean, this is not. I'm blessed that I don't have to spend most of my days gaming out, how to make threats and counter threats effectively. But you can see the logic here, right? I think the way to react to this, as not as threat makers who are in this position, but as just readers of the New York Times, where this Biden's piece was published, is to just take a step back and sort of gasp in horror at A, how difficult this is, and B, how dangerous it is, right? The idea that a miscalibrated threat could lead to nuclear war is terrifying because, we've had a lot of leaders either in office recently or in office currently of nuclear states who are quite capable of issuing miscalibrated threats. So it's really scary that the Biden administration finds itself in this position, and this just has to do with how many nuclear weapons there are on the planet, of having to, just get it just right to try to avoid the possibility of nuclear missiles firing.
And it's also complicated, right? Because, there's the question of whether a less than nuclear strike on Russia in response to its use of a nuclear weapon would signal to other nuclear states like China that they could somehow use their weapons to get what they really want.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, it's such a grim logic when you have to game it out. And I'm not going to pretend to be an expert in exactly, what level of tit for tat retaliation is precise. But that's why it's so scary. And you know what? And all of this is a rule book that no one really knows and that we're rewriting every day. I mean, there's the hope is that there's a shared enough expectation, even among rival states, even when they're basically at war or approaching the point of being at war, that they understand what would trigger a nuclear war and they will all agree not to do that thing. But my gosh, how much faith do you have that there is a shared sense of understanding among the heads of the nine nuclear states on exactly where the line is and on the fact that no one will cross it?
What sort of images did the world get following the devastation caused in Japan by the nuclear bombs the U.S. dropped?
Well, at first, the images were strictly censored because right after Japan suffered both thoroughgoing bombing by conventional bombs and firebombing, but then atomic bombs, Japan was occupied by the United States, and images and depictions of the post-war destruction, particularly of the post-war nuclear destruction, were censored. So the people who were speaking most about the bomb were the military scientists who had designed it and the military that had dropped it. And you got two different messages there, from one hand, from the Truman administration, bragged about the United States had just bombed a Japanese military target. That's how we described Hiroshima, as if the whole city were a base or something like that, rather than a city where civilians lived. But on the other hand, you had a lot of atomic scientists, including Albert Einstein, saying this is so dangerous that it is a political game changer on the most fundamental level. And even the basic fact of our international politics, which is we are divided up into different countries, that's going to be something we're going to have to rethink. We have to have a single world government because there is no other way to control the nuclear weapons. So that was the kind of discussion until 1946, when a New Yorker reporter named John Hersey issued wrote a really remarkable long article that got published as a book that captured the survivors' stories and broadcast to the world something that had been controlled information and only locally known in Japan, which is not what it looked like to design a bomb or to drop a bomb, but what it felt like to be bombed.
What role had Einstein actually played in the U.S. developing nuclear weapons on the timetable it did?
He's the one who had proposed it. It wasn't him alone who'd done this, but he wrote a letter, which you can see it's online, to FDR in 1939, explaining the possibilities of an atomic bomb and outlining the threat that German scientists were working on it and strongly suggesting that the United States needed to start a nuclear program in order to get the bomb before Hitler did. FDR didn't act on that immediately. The initial funding for the development of the bomb was something on the order of $6,000. Einstein was the one who pushed the United States to develop the bomb in the first place.
Did he come to regret that?
He came to fear the bomb, but he also explained his actions and understood his actions within the context of a war. He was worried that Adolf Hitler would have the bomb and no one else would, and that Adolf Hitler would use the bomb to win the war and then would drop many bombs on many cities. And that I think that is a real fear. But by the time the United States developed the bomb and dropped the bomb, he also worried about another just one country having a bomb, which is the United States. A lot of the atomic scientists were in the United States, but they hadn't been born in the United States. And I think it violated their sense of justice and safety that one country would just have an atomic monopoly. And that's why so many of the atomic scientists became, and this was actually a worldwide movement that a lot of people, not just them, signed on to, but so many people came to feel that it was important to have some kind of world government or federation just to make sure that no country had all the bombs.
This is such an interesting idea because, I mean, we know it never quite happened. And now this idea is anathema to a lot of people, particularly nationalist conservatives. It seems like some kind of evil plot rather than a way of protecting everyone on the planet.
The idea of, and let's just be clear about what we mean by world government. We mean something, not just the United Nations as it currently exists. We mean a government that has the power of war and peace, not necessarily the power of tax, but at least the power to kind of stop all wars that it's not responsible for, and has military power to which all existing countries are subordinate. So that is, for example, the relationship between Idaho and the United States government. Idaho cannot declare its own foreign policy, cannot go to war. It's part of a larger country. It has its own laws, but it is subordinate to the government of the United States. That's what Einstein is proposing. And that's what a lot of people at the time are extremely excited by and also convinced that it seems like an inevitability. One of the, this is a small thing, but the chancellor of the University of Chicago, at right after the bomb is dropped on Hiroshima and the other one on Nagasaki, says, "You know, I thought world government was just crazy until August 1945, and then I realized that it was necessary." He convenes a committee of, you know, all the leading intellectuals in Chicago to draft a constitution for the world government, and he says in the preface, "You know, the reason we're doing this is we all agree that this is going to have to happen. We all are convinced that world government is an inevitability, and we'd like to get the details right."
So, John Hersey wrote this extremely influential piece for The New Yorker that, as you say, was turned into a book. Lots of people understood the consequences of these weapons through his eyes. There were also direct survivor accounts that played into the way previous generations understood the potential of nuclear weapons. Tell us a little bit about that.
So, what Hersey did was he stepped back. So, the book isn't a lot of, you know, him walking through the ruins of Hiroshima and commenting on his feelings. It's rather stories of six survivors whom he interviewed and told through their eyes what it felt like. But these survivors themselves also continued to tell the story. And one in particular, a man named Kiyoshi Tanimoto, who starts out, he's the first figure that of the six figures that Hersey focuses on, traveled to the United States, spoke at hundreds in hundreds of cities, addressed Congress, both the House and the Senate, and did a lot along with a lot of other survivors to get the testimony out there because they felt like they had a really special and important story to tell that very few, that no one else in the world could tell, and the world listened. By the 1960s, the idea of, you know, being a Hiroshima or Nagasaki survivor, that was a particular status and role that you had in global memory and global politics. And those testimonies were sought after, repeated, reprinted, in all kinds of ways.
And contrary to what we would all like to believe, one of the things he helped to drive home was the fact that dying as a result of a nuclear attack doesn't necessarily happen instantaneously. It's not that you have no idea what hit you.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the indications that our nuclear consciousness is atrophying, is that a lot of people, when they imagine nuclear war, they don't imagine it as Tanimoto described it, which is you've lived through this. A lot of your loved ones haven't, but there are a lot of people who are badly injured who are still alive. The hospitals have all been bombed. Many of the doctors are dead, but not all of them. And suddenly everyone in the city needs medical care all at once, and they're suffering from this indescribable new thing, radiation sickness. All those kinds of gritty and sort of unbearable details, I think, fade away and have been replaced in a lot of people's minds with, oh, nuclear war means there's a fungal puff and a flash of light, and you vanish. And I mean, I don't think any of us wants to vanish like that, but that sounds a lot more livable than the reality of nuclear war, which is that a lot of people live through it. I mean, the majority of people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki survived, and they just had to bear the unbearable.
Okay, I want to go to the phones. We have Brian on the line in Fort Worth, Texas. Hi, Brian.
Hey, hello
Hi.
there.
Hi, what's on your mind, Brian?
I wanted to mention that Dan Carlin does a podcast, and one of his shows is called The Destroyer of Worlds. And I think it would really do justice, or it does justice to the question of, how scary policy is around nuclear weapons, how it developed from the United States being the only country with weapons to two countries and more, and how close we've come through history to actually going to war, to nuclear war.
Thanks very much for calling. Daniel, I don't know if you're familiar with the podcast, but what do you know about, the idea that first it was just the United States and then we had proliferation happening, and now as these kind of nuclear states on the edge, places like Iran and North Korea are gaining access to this technology, we've simply had to just accept it, right? Even though nobody thinks it's a good idea.
It's not quite true that nobody thinks it's a good idea. There are two theories on this. One theory is that nuclear weapons ultimately keep countries safe. They make it just too dangerous to invade that country. So they not only the presence of nuclear weapons not only deters a nuclear war, it also deters an invasion. And if that's your it's a grim theory, but if that's your theory, you might be very concerned that Ukraine voluntarily gave up its nuclear arsenal in the 90s. And you might think, well, if Ukraine hadn't done that, it wouldn't be in the position it's in today. So if that's your theory, you might rejoice in the fact that now almost 50% of the population lives in a nuclear state. But the flip side of that is now there are nine different governments that have to successfully, neither by accident nor by just a fit of madness, drop a nuclear bomb or fire a nuclear missile. That's a lot of complicated politics and logistics that all has to go right, and it has to go right every day for us to be free of nuclear war.
How did fears about all-out nuclear war change the nature of wars after the mid-40s?
So there has been a decline in war since World War II. You are less likely to die in war now, significantly less likely than you would have been in the early 20th century and certainly in the 19th century. We've absolutely had wars and they've been horrifically destructive. But political scientists sometimes like to categorize wars as those involving great powers and those not involving great powers, and they sometimes debate who's a great power. There hasn't really been a great power war since, the 1950s when the United States and China clashed during the Korean War. And it seems like the kind of World War I or World War II style war where the largest countries are directly fighting each other. And those wars, by and large, tend to be far the most dangerous wars. We haven't had those wars since. We've had border clashes. We've had very serious civil wars. We've had invasions of, a very powerful country will invade a weaker country, but we haven't had the kind of, all-out food fight, everyone is involved war since World War II. And that, I think, is can be credited to the fact that a lot fewer people are dying from war than they used to. And one strong argument, is that nuclear weapons have played a role in that. They've just made it too expensive for large countries to get in large wars.
Of course, the thing about the existence of a technology is that it's really hard to know it's an option and not be tempted to use it. Remind folks of what got Douglas MacArthur fired from his command position during the Korean War.
Yeah, this is a really good example of just the kind of alsos or almosts that mark war. So you don't usually think of the Korean War in the early 1950s as a nuclear war, but it almost was. It was run by the Truman administration, which had just been in power during the only other nuclear war or the only nuclear war that had ever happened, World War II. And it was quite thinkable that as UN forces who were under US command were finding themselves bogged down and at certain moments retreating on the Korean Peninsula, that they would use the weapon that they had. And Douglas MacArthur, who was in charge of those forces, was very eager to use nuclear weapons after he was was taken off. He said he wanted to use 30 to 50 nuclear weapons. He was removed, and Truman didn't use nuclear weapons, but he did get ready to use them.
Daniel, of course, people got news and first-person accounts of the bombing in the aftermath, the bombings at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. How did our obsession with nuclear annihilation shape the kinds of movies people saw in the decades that followed, the stories we told each other?
It's really interesting because you might think that people in the United States would not really imagine themselves as Japanese, not really imagine themselves as in the boots of people from Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But there were a lot of not only things like Duck and Cover, but films that really spelled out what it would feel like if there was a nuclear attack on New York City or Cleveland or something like that. And there was a lot of interest in imagining that. There are some big films like On the Beach in 1959 or The Day After in 1983 that helped keep the nuclear consciousness alive, to help remind people why, you know, what lay at the root of foreign policy and what they had to be afraid of. And people who've seen those movies, especially at an impressionable age, really, you know, felt the fear and were deeply shaped by those films.
I hadn't realized the Godzilla character was said to, in the story, to have been sort of activated by some kind of nuclear testing.
It's different in the two versions of the movie. So the Japanese film Gojira was in reaction to a nuclear test that the United States did near Japan in the Pacific that got out of hand and sent radiation into Japan and actually irradiated a group of Japanese, a boat of Japanese fishermen. That became a huge scandal in Japan, and it inspired the movie Godzilla, which in the Japanese version is about a monster who's been awakened by nuclear testing, and at the end, who might again be awakened if there's more nuclear testing. The Hollywood version took a lot of the Japanese footage, spliced in a white actor, and actually took out a lot of the anti-nuclear politics.
So fear can cause us to take appropriate precautions and to sort of be as ready as we can possibly be. It can also cause us to feel like there's nothing we can do. How did that psychic toll of fear change global culture?
I think it changed it. Well, I think you have to imagine it not just changing, you know, what movies get made, but changing families and people's lives in a deep way. I mean, one thing that I found out after I published this article is a lot of people wrote to me and just told me their family history with nuclear fear. And I have my own family history. There is my uncle and aunt got married young and had kids because they were both convinced that they might not live very long. And so they should just do it. And they should just rush into getting married. And I think a lot of people, you know, in their families, there may be a kind of a marriage, a divorce, a birth, a non-birth that in some way, conscious or unconscious, was urged along by the reinforced fear that life may not last very long. And that's not just a sort of, you know, if you're a scared person, you think that. But, you know, we're talking about the president of the United States going on TV and saying to people, build bomb bunkers immediately. We might have nuclear war very soon.
What are the parallels between the sort of never again ethos of remembering the Holocaust in Europe and the way Hiroshima and Nagasaki are remembered in Japan? And where do those parallels start to fall apart?
I think it's a good and interesting comparison because it used to be the case that Hiroshima and Auschwitz were sort of twins, both avatars of the unspeakable, and they had a shared place in global memory. There was, you know, Hiroshima would be remembered on Hiroshima Day, which was celebrated, or not celebrated, but commemorated globally in 1963. Some 45 Danish towns had Hiroshima Day commemorations or events or protests of nuclear policy. So that wasn't uncommon. And that slipped a lot, however. It is now the case that we have all kinds of ways of reminding ourselves of the Holocaust and reminding ourselves that it must never happen again. There's more than 100 Holocaust museums and memorials. But remembrance of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, I think, has retreated to the point where it is very much a Japanese thing, but not really part of global memory as much as it used to be.
Do you think the global memory of the bombings in Japan was shaped or maybe warped by American exceptionalism and the sort of cultural hegemony we have around the world, so that it took a long time for Americans to come to terms with the fact that this was an exceptionally destructive act and that we may not have been told the truth about whether or not it was truly necessary?
Yeah, one of the really interesting differences between Auschwitz and Hiroshima as never again things that must be remembered and who, you know, from which the survivors must and their testimony must be circulated and paid deep attention to, is that in the case of Hiroshima, the perpetrator won the war. And a lot of the early attempts to commemorate Hiroshima from and Nagasaki from inside Japan had to deal with the fact that the United States was continuing to occupy Japan, and people like Kiyoshi Tanimoto found ways to do what historian Carol Gluck calls history in the passive voice, to refer to the bomb as something that happened, not a choice that was made, but just sort of a natural event, and then describe all the trauma as if this had been a hurricane or an earthquake or something like that, to find ways of talking about the trauma without naming a perpetrator. And that question of, can we remember the horrors of nuclear war without talking about the choice to drop the bomb, has made it really hard and sometimes quite awkward to talk about Hiroshima ever since.
Who was Vasily Arkhipov, and what is his, frankly, forgotten role in world history?
I'm so glad we are talking about him. So this is really one of the most remarkable scares in a decades-long history that has many scares. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, famously, Kennedy and Khrushchev were both, entering into increasingly difficult negotiation, as first Kennedy had stationed nuclear missiles in Turkey, and then Khrushchev responded by stationing them in Cuba. And it was just a really scary moment, because it looked like it looked possible that a side might fire a preemptive nuclear strike. And indeed, Kennedy's advisors were strongly advising him to do that. But on the other hand, we now know that neither Kennedy nor Khrushchev actually wanted to go to war. And so for all the heated talk, neither of them was particularly inclined to actually do it. So you might think, okay, it seemed scary at the time, but, ultimately it was going to be okay. However, at the same time, the Soviet Admiralty sends nuclear torpedoes to Cuba on submarines. These submarines are they're submarines, so they're submerged. They're out of radio contact. They miss all of this hasty diplomacy, and they're also designed for the North Sea, so they don't have air conditioning. One of the nuclear powered it's not nuclear powered, it has a nuclear torpedo on it. One of the submarines is out of fresh water. Its batteries are dying. It's unspeakably hot inside the submarine, and it is trapped under a U.S. warship near the Caribbean in Cuba. The captain of the sub has no idea what's going on, does not know anything that Khrushchev and Kennedy have worked out. And the warship above it tries to signal to it to surface by dropping depth charges, practice depth charges, on it as a signal. Now, that's a pretty aggressive signal, and the Russian captain doesn't really know how to respond, and so doesn't surface. And so then the U.S., a U.S. skipper, switches to another unauthorized and insanely reckless tactic, which is dropping live grenades on the submarine. These are scary. They're exploding on the submarine. The Soviet captain figures there's a war on, and so he gives an order to ready the nuclear torpedo, and he says, we're going to fire it, right? The war is clearly on. We're not going to bring shame to the fleet. We're going to fire a nuclear weapon. This would have been the first nuclear weapon fired since Nagasaki, and he is given the order to fire it. However, it takes a little bit to sort of set all that up, and in that little bit of time, it turns out that there is another Soviet officer randomly stationed on the submarine, Vasily Arkhipov, who hastily negotiates with the captain and gets him to back down. It turns out that Arkhipov, just months before, I think 15 months before, had been on a Soviet nuclear-powered submarine that had a nuclear accident that had killed 22 of his 138 shipmates, meaning that he was one of the only people who had had a recent experience with nuclear disaster. And historians have interviewed his wife, and she explained, that's why he did it. That's why he absolutely made sure that that missile wasn't fired, is because he knew what nuclear disaster looked like. He'd experienced it himself. He had that experiential knowledge, and he's the hero. He's the one who prevents this from becoming nuclear war. Arthur Schlesinger Jr., the historian who spent a lot of time in the Kennedy administration, said that moment with the submarine, which only came out, you know, decades later, we only understood how dangerous it was. He said that was the most dangerous moment in world history.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. We have Michael on the line in Grand Prairie. Hi, Michael.
Hey, Chris. Hey, thanks to you, I am a sustaining member. And
thank
I'm
you.
Interested in y'all's thoughts on the agreement that Ukraine entered into to give up its nuclear arsenal. And also, do you think some people are falling into a false sense of security after the Chernobyl and Three Mile Island and Fukushima? And thank you.
Thanks for your call.
You know, Michael, that's a great question. And it's worth saying that multiple countries have had nuclear arsenals and have given them up. You think of the bomb as the kind of thing that once you have it, you hold on to it. But Ukraine made the decision to get rid of its arsenal. Now, that arsenal would have been difficult to maintain. It would have involved Ukraine in, you know, nuclear standoffs. I mean, it's not an easy thing to have nuclear weapons, but Ukraine accepted a security guarantee, or it felt like it had enough of a security guarantee from NATO. It's not a member of NATO, but that it could safely get rid of nuclear weapons in exchange for military aid. And on the one hand, that's a very admirable decision. But Michael, as you said, it comes from a sense of security, and some might say even false security, as we see. You know, now Ukraine is being invaded by a nuclear power.
Do you have any sense of how willing Vladimir Putin might be to use a nuclear weapon in Ukraine?
I don't. And I think we always end up asking this question, both retrospectively as historians and in these moments of, you know, nuclear flare-ups, like when Trump and North Korea were trading threats in 2017. You know, you want to think, of course, no one's actually going to fire these weapons. But the logic of nuclear confrontation produces people, incentivizes people to be as credible as possible in making nuclear threats. Putin wants everyone to believe that he is absolutely capable of using a tactical nuclear weapon if whatever line he's articulating is crossed. Of course he wants people to believe that. And when you have this game being played where you win by making credible threats, it's entirely possible. First of all, it becomes very hard to distinguish. Is that a real threat? Is that a credible threat? Would he actually do it? By design, it's hard to figure that out. And it's really terrifying to be a civilian just watching this. But that kind of milieu also, in a sort of Darwinian way, selects for people who can seem crazy and who might actually have the conviction that they'd be willing to do it. It really does seem, we know the most about the U.S. side of it, but it really does seem that a lot of the men who were pretty high up in nuclear commands really were willing to drop nuclear bombs and fire nuclear missiles. And in some ways, that was part of their ability to make effective threats, was they actually were serious about being willing to do it.
Besides reading well-reasoned essays like the ones you've put in The Guardian, Daniel, what do you think might convince people of your generation, and especially the generation of young people that you're teaching, right, that Gen Z, that this is an ongoing threat?
Yeah, it's really tricky. I mean, there used to be, you know, a lot of the things that reinforced people's sense of it was the atmospheric test. And I'm thrilled that people are no longer detonating nuclear bombs above ground anymore. It was really bad for the environment. It's really scary. But it did kind of reinforce a nuclear consciousness, as did the films. Yeah, I mean, I think I wish we didn't have to talk about it, right? I mean, I don't want people to live in fear. I'm not, you know, I don't love the idea that my parents grew up afraid for their lives all the time. That's horrifying and it's traumatizing. But the way you respond to a danger can't just be shrugging it off. The way you respond to a danger is you take it seriously. And there are things we can do. We can dismantle nuclear arsenals. We can strengthen treaties. We can reinforce anti-nuclear norms. Currently, we are doing the opposite of all of those things. And that's the scary part. And when that's happening, you think we should be taking this more seriously. We should be more afraid of it. And whether that happens by, you know, reading essays or watching films, we have to do something.
Daniel Immerwahr is Associate Professor of History at Northwestern University. His essay for The Guardian was titled Forgetting the Apocalypse, Why Our Nuclear Fears Faded and Why That's Dangerous. Daniel, thanks very much for making time to talk with us.
Chris, it's such a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
You can like our page on Facebook. On Twitter, we are at KERA Think. Do subscribe to our podcast wherever you get podcasts, or check us out on the website think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.